and welcome to Life Matters. Natasha Mitchell joining you on RN Summer. Great to have you with us, especially today. I am pleased to say we have a raucous, robust, raunchy hour ahead for you. Self-professed bad feminist Dr. Roxane Gay is my guest, coming to you from the stage of the Sydney Opera House for a no-holds-barred conversation about feminism, about pop culture, about sexuality, about rap music, about a whole lot more. Roxane, you might know, is the author of the New York Times best-selling collection of essays, Bad Feminist, also a striking novel, An Untamed State. She's a celebrated American essayist, columnist and commentator and an assistant professor of English at Purdue University. Love to hear from you today. Don't just shout or laugh or cheer at the radio. Tweet us at RN Life Matters or join the conversation on our Facebook page. And just a warning, if the radio is on at home with you and the kids, well, our conversation includes some strong language and sexually explicit themes, which, as you can imagine, made the prospect of her parents being in the audience very interesting. They were travelling with her in Australia, but we weren't sure if they'd turned up on the day. Let's find out.
Oh, yeah, this is happening.
Are Roxane's parents in the room?
Oh.
We wondered.
They're horrible parents.
I sometimes cringe when I'm called a feminist. You write that in this book.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel that still?
No. No, I just cringe when I'm called a bad feminist. I think that it's the F word. And when you are called a feminist, it's never a compliment. Someone's saying, oh, how dare you? You have the audacity to believe you're equal to a man? You have the audacity to believe you have bodily autonomy? Well, yes, actually I do. And it's funny that those very basic desires have become so maligned by the people who have the most to lose if we are indeed equal. Mm. So I don't cringe as much as I used to, but there is still, unfortunately, a stigma to the word.
Is feminism for you? I get frustrated that we always come back to this kind of baseline that feminism, you're a feminist if you believe in equality of the sexes.
Mm-hmm.
Is that enough?
Yes.
But let's just explore that further. What do we mean by equality?
I mean, yes, it's enough, and no, it isn't. Mm. It really depends. But, you know, feminism is a lot of different things to a lot of different people, but I do think that we need to have some core goals in common. And one is that we should be able to move through the world in the same way as men. But we were just doing a panel, me and several other feminists, and one of the key things that came up is that equality isn't enough because we need to overturn the patriarchal structures, because right now we're striving for equality in a system that's already broken. Mm-hmm. And I do tend to agree with that, but the more realistic part of me also recognizes that this is the system we have. And I think we can work toward overturning the system, but in the meantime, let's also make life more livable with the system we have. And so I do think starting with the idea of equality is a good place to start. And we can then build upon that. Everything starts somewhere and every movement needs a foundation.
Because I remember when I was, you know, doing engineering, they would say, we need more girls in engineering because we're not drawing on the talents of 50% of the gene pool. And so that was kind of the default position. And for me, it went further than that. It wasn't just about getting equal numbers of women into engineering or women feeling that they had equal access to a non-traditional profession like that. But it was also that, oh, hang on, I had this feeling that women brought something distinct by virtue of their gender to a profession that hadn't seen women.
I think people bring something distinct. I think we're all individuals. And so I think the push to get more women in engineering is in part because people want to see more equity, but I do also think that it is recognizing that perhaps women have something different to offer. Mm-hmm. And a new way of thinking about the structures of the world that we live in. So it's interesting because on the one hand, you worry about these constant calls for equity in certain fields, but I think it's, again, a good place to start. Like, yeah, let's start with having more than one woman in an engineering class with 23 men. That's not a lot to ask for.
Yeah, it's amazing how little things have changed, actually. What is that about? Bad feminist, why did you feel the need to name yourself a bad feminist?
Well, it started tongue-in-cheek. It just sounded funny. And so I was like, yes, I'm going to call myself a bad feminist because I'm very bad at feminism. Oh, so bad. But I also wanted to... I wanted to claim feminism while also acknowledging that I'm not perfect. And I felt like I needed to do that and to have that acknowledgement. But it was also a correction to feminism that has historically excluded women of color, working class women, transgender women, disabled women. If that's good feminism, then yes. I'm a very bad feminist because I believe in inclusion and intersectionality. So it's both of those things.
Mm-hmm. I mean, some would say it sets up a false dichotomy, mm-hmm. that really what you're meaning is that bad feminism is good feminism. And good feminism is bad feminism because yes. It's not inclusive and broad and it is rigid in its thinking. But isn't that in a way, and I know you would have been asked this before, but isn't that a way... fulfilling the very stereotype that you're resisting in some sense, that to name some feminists as good and some as bad is an act of exclusion?
No. No, I don't think... I think we can say that being exclusive and being bigoted means you can't play on our feminist island. I think it's okay to do that. And I don't think it's being exclusionary, it's just saying that that sort of toxic attitude is not going to help feminism, and it's actually not feminist. And I'm very comfortable with that.
And there are beautiful stories about your contradictory existence. And it does start with music in some ways. So tell us, in the same way I guess I love punk and it's full of misogyny, you love rap and you pump it up really loud.
I do. You know, I love all music, and all music is pretty much terrible to women. Except for classical, because it's just... But I listen to hip-hop sometimes, and it's so, so horrible. And I know that it's bad. And I know that I should be ashamed of myself, that I'm like, yeah, on the way to work. But I still don't think that makes me less of a feminist. It just makes me... weak.
Really? Is yes. that why you'd think of it?
Absolutely, because really? I think that if I was like a good feminist or if I was strong, I would withhold such pleasure from myself because the pleasure is not enough to compensate for the degradation that those kinds of lyrics really depict. They should do better, and we should expect them to do better. And so I get really frustrated, especially when it's a talented artist like Kendrick Lamar. Bitch, don't kill my vibe. I love that song, but why does he have to bring bitch into it? That's unnecessary, and it's lazy, and I just want him to be better.
And he's laying awake at night.
What does Roxane Gay think of my music? Well, Kendrick.
Yes. But I guess the thing is, you're listening to that music, and you're listening it through with the lens that you can.
Yes.
As a feminist, adult woman in control of your own interests and passions. What about girls?
Well, I think that's what the real task is. I mean, we have two things that we need to do. And one is that we need to create popular culture that doesn't degrade women, but that can still be mindless. I mean, I'm not saying everything needs to be nutritious. Oh, that would suck. But I am saying that we can do better, that we can write dirty sex songs without degrading women. I mean, you want to have sex with a woman and you're going to just say, like, treat her like crap? That's not a good strategy. So we need to do that, but we also need to increase media literacy for young men and women so that they understand the messages that they're consuming. At 40 years old, it's totally fine. Like, I can hear the music and I know what's wrong, but I have a 3-year-old niece. And you know, we listen to music around her, but the older she gets, the more I pay attention to the lyrics, and I just think, I don't want this baby hearing this kind of lyric and then thinking that this is an acceptable way for her to be viewed as a young woman. And I don't want my nephew thinking that it's an acceptable way for him to view young women. And so I think we have to teach young people literacy, and this kind of literacy, a sort of feminism-based media literacy.
Mm. I mean, almost use the music as a point of discussion.
Absolutely.
But then at some point you have to go, one of the kids might, well, why does it exist then?
Yeah. Because, well, supply and demand, and that's what it comes back to eventually. At some point, we're going to have to make the hard decision to say, I'm not going to consume this culture anymore, so that they have the financial imperative to do better.
Author of the book Bad Feminist, American essayist and commentator Dr. Roxane Gay is our guest on Life Matters Today here on ABC RN. Natasha Mitchell with you, along with a very, very lively audience at the Sydney Opera House who turned up in their droves to see Roxane. Tweet with us today at RN Life Matters. And if you're just tuning in, a warning that today's conversation with Roxane contains some very strong language and content of a sexual nature.
I hate to bring it up, but I'm gonna. Mm-hmm. 50 Shades of Grey.
Hell yeah.
Yeah. Because I will admit, who's read it?
Liars.
Who hasn't read it?
Oh, wow.
What?
Guys.
How representative a sample of... This is a multi-million dollar publishing phenomenon. Why?
Oh, why? Well, that's a
and
very good question.
And you've read all of them?
I have read all of them.
Twice.
I just saw my dad.
Look, Dad, you're just going to have to cope.
Close your ears. Why? Why is 50 Shades of Grey popular? I think because it taps into this idea that women's pleasure matters and that women's pleasure can be centered, and it focuses on the female gaze to an extent. And it's also, he's a billionaire. He's young, he's handsome, he's fit, and he gives her free gifts. Oh, and he flies a helicopter. His own helicopter. And so...
That's important.
Oh, it's so important.
Female gaze.
Yes.
Just describe...
The female gaze, like that women get to look upon the male body and find it desirable. And that desire counts as much as a man looking upon a woman's body. And so I think it was a series of books that was just desperately needed. And the desperation is why the shitty books did so well.
But there's been lots of other good female erotica and kink. Why did that cut through?
Because I don't know.
The juggernaut.
Because I think it's because he's a billionaire. And it's like, it's wish fulfillment. Everything about that book is wish fulfillment. Oh, I fell asleep. My driver went out and bought you La Perla lingerie. I mean, if that happened, I would be like, yes. I'm driving a crappy car. Here's a new Audi. My computer's broken. Here's a MacBook. I live for this kind of thing. And so it's good stuff.
So what about the sex?
Oh, and also the sex. I'm trying not to talk about the sex. Thank you.
Sorry, Dad, you're just going to have to cope.
The sex is also pretty erotic, I guess. I don't know. I mean, I've never had it.
Would it help? Would it help if we brought him up on the stage?
No, I'm good. You know, I think that the sex, again, was very, very Anna-focused. So for those of you who aren't familiar with 50 Shades of Grey, Anastasia Grey is a 21-year-old college, about-to-graduate young woman who's never had sex and who has never masturbated.
Now, look, we've just got to get this back on track.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
I mean, for a start, what's a 20-year-old not having... Why has she never masturbated before?
Yes, exactly. There's so much going on there. It's fascinating. So she's just a tabula rasa. She is a blank canvas. And then she meets Christian Grey, the billionaire. And, of course, he's like the freakiest freak. But he's not that freaky. And the first time they have sex, he finds out that she's a virgin. And he says, okay, this situation must be rectified. Literally something he says, which is what I think it's what every woman wants to hear during her first time.
It's actually comedy gold. That's the secret.
It is. And so the situation is rectified. And
in three books.
Oh, yes. And he makes her come just by stimulating her nipples, even though she's never been touched before. It's amazing. He's a magician.
We laugh about this, but, you know, women the world over have said this is in... You've said it pathologizes BDSM.
Yes.
It doesn't quite get it right.
Yes.
The consent business actually is implicit to good bondage sadomasochistic relationships.
Mm-hmm.
But also the world of women who work with domestic violence are so distressed by this book.
Yes.
Because it legitimizes control and violence in an intimate relationship.
Yes.
So this is a tricky line to walk.
It is. The sex is great and funny and absurd. The romance is nice. The tragic billionaire situation is nice. The S&M is fine. None of that is the problem. The problem is that he's a psycho stalker. He puts a thing in her phone to track her whereabouts. Because he doesn't want her to go topless on their honeymoon, he marks her with hickeys all over her chest. I mean, this is like someone... Right. He's not good. He's a bad, bad man. And he's boring. And that's offensive. And so it's not about S&M being violent. It's about everything he does outside of the bedroom being passive-aggressive, controlling, and violent. And what it basically says is that true love is when a man wants to control every single aspect of your life.
Or that your ultimate desires are fulfilled when you let a little control
yes,
into your life.
Absolutely. It's not about... BDSM is about consensual surrender. Mm-hmm. And another issue throughout the books is that Anastasia only gives reluctant consent. She doesn't even really know what she's getting into. And he is into it because he's trying to punish his mother, who was a crackhead. True story. And that's where the pathologizing comes in, where he's into S&M because he's deeply dark and damaged, when such is not the case, necessarily. I think there are many reasons, but I support the general idea of the books because far be it from me to insult like 40 million women. Like, there's something going on there. So do we say 40 million women are stupid? No, I don't think we do that. Mm-hmm. So we can acknowledge that the books have some major issues while also acknowledging that they're tapping into desire. And clearly a lot of women are under-fucked.
What do you think this obsession is about? Just to shift gears somewhat.
Yes, please.
With naming, pinning the tail on the donkey, so to speak, with getting women in public life mm-hmm. to name themselves as feminists or not. So, you know, Beyonce is, Taylor Swift wasn't, but now she is. She's had an awakening. There's something about that desire to name our figureheads.
Yes.
But it's a very strange exchange that goes on, I think. What do you think is going on there? Is it good?
I think that there's a desire to label people across all manner of identities. And so on the one hand, we just want to know, are you a feminist or not? But when it comes to celebrity women and some of the men, I think it's a leading question. It's a question designed to trap and make them say something stupid.
Mm.
And 9 times out of 10, if you ask a 20-year-old actress, she says something absolutely insane, like, I love men. Girl, nobody cares. You know.
But they do care. Because then
they don't really care about the instant sort of, oh, she made a mistake, let's jump on her because we're jealous because she's in Divergent. We can do better than that. I think we have to ask better questions, not are you a feminist, but how has feminism made your life possible?
Mm.
Like, ask more nuanced questions, and I suspect we'll get better answers.
But then people will say, well, feminists did good stuff for me and my heritage, but now it's not relevant to me. Fixed. Everything's fixed.
Well, that's a nice delusion.
But it's a delusion that a lot of young women have. And if we think about the social media campaign, you know, Women Against Feminism last year, where I don't know whether you're familiar with that. So people, actually very interesting, really worth looking at the Tumblr actually, because it's a group of women posting photos of themselves holding up a placard listing the reasons why they are not a feminist, hashtag women against feminism. Some quite interesting reasons that they gave.
Yeah, no. You know, I think that those women, I think we oftentimes denounce feminism because we don't want to be seen as difficult and we don't want to be seen as not appreciating those in power. And so I think it's a choice that's oftentimes made out of fear, even if we don't realize that's why we're making that choice. When you look at what a lot of those women said, basically they were saying, I am not trying to make trouble for men. And I understand that. They've been socialized and acculturated in ways that make them realize it's not safe to say I'm a feminist. It's not safe to say I believe I'm equal and I deserve to be paid the same as you. It's not safe to say that my body shouldn't be legislated. And so they come up with these cute little signs, or I'm a feminist because I work hard. Who doesn't?
Well, some of them were, I'm not a feminist because... And they were parents of sons, for example, mothers mm-hmm. of sons who felt that they had some responsibility for the disenfranchisement of their little boys or the men in their life. Or how do you view that discussion about men feeling disenfranchised from feminism?
I think men try to make everything about them. It's just not about them. And, you know...
But it is about them.
No,
it's
not.
It is about them. But they're part of it.
Yes and no.
Women exist in the world with men.
Yes, we do, but who cares? I mean, why are we always trying to hold men's hand and make them feel better about feminism? Like, they feel disenfranchised and I'm supposed to take time out of my day as a black woman to care? No. You know, for me, that's just never going to happen. I love men. I have two brothers. I have a father. I have a nephew. All the men in my life are fantastic men. And they don't sit around worrying about feminism. They just are good men. And even though they probably wouldn't call themselves feminists, they're feminists. This idea that we have to make feminism palatable to men and make them feel okay with our desire for equality is just not something I will ever take part in. And so, yes, we do share the world with men, and we do have to work with men, but I don't think we need to lay out the red carpet and give them cookies. And when you're raising sons, I think that makes it even more important for you to be a feminist, so that you're raising them to see their mothers and sisters and friends as equal, and so that they know to treat not only other women but other young men in ways that are ethical, in ways that are humane, so that when they're young boys and they go on the school bus and they see a bunch of kids picking on a girl or a boy, they know to say, don't do that. I mean, it's about raising good people, and I think feminism can contribute to that.
So this is as much about this conversation that we're having about men and women relating to each other, but also there's a chapter in here, how to be friends with another woman. A set of instructions for how women can talk to women, or how women can become friends with women. Why do you feel the need to instruct women about that?
When I wrote that essay, I was Sheila Hetty's book, How Should a Person Be, had just come out. And a couple of the reviews talked about how the book exemplified why women can never be friends. And I personally found that the friendship between the two primary women, Sheila and Margot, in the book was a gorgeous example of female friendship. It was complicated and messy, but it was true. And so I started to think about the female or the friendships I have with other women. And I remember in high school and even early college, I would say, all my friends are guys. And I was so proud of that. Like, maybe they'll like me as one of them. Mm. And, you know, I grew out of that, thank God. And so I started to think about, what is it about friendships between women that get so demonized, and everyone acts like it's only friendships between women that are bitchy and toxic, as if men just get along and wars don't exist. And so I started to come up with this list as I thought through my own friendships, and more importantly, my own journey towards, I think, becoming a better friend to other women.
Because women aren't always friends to each other. They don't always support each other. Is that anything to do with their gender?
No. I think that people don't support each other. I think that it's a very competitive world, and that there's a finite number of resources, and sometimes we turn against each other because we worry that we're not going to get enough of what we want.
Do you think it's, though, partly about the way the world responds to our gender? So, for example, the dynamics of women and men in workplaces, for example, where you find women not always supporting each other. Generalization?
No. Yes, I see that happen, but I think people try to make it seem like this is a unique thing that happens among women, but men backstab each other in the workplace all the time, and nobody says, is that a man thing? So I think it's about competition and scarcity and fear. You know, I know that there is this idea that women can be very toxic to one another in the workplace, and sometimes we go into various environments with a Highlander attitude. There can be only one, and so we're not willing to help each other. But I don't blame us. I blame the system for making us think that we need to turn against one another. So I'm always going to be very reluctant to put that on something about being with gender. I think it has everything to do with scarcity.
Everything to do with scarcity. On Life Matters Today, Natasha Mitchell joining you with Dr. Roxane Gay. She's the author of the New York Times bestseller Bad Feminism. It's a collection of essays exploring feminism and gender and pop culture and sex and violence and race and rape and rap music. Roxane's essays range far and wide. She is frank, she is fearless. And so a reminder that today's conversation contains strong language and sexually explicit themes.
Roxane, your novel, An Untamed State, describes a gang rape. And an essay in this book, an incredible essay, What We Hunger For, describes your own experience of the very same as a little girl, mm-hmm. a young teenager, right there at the beginning of your teens. What's been the impact of telling that story, both on yourself but those you talk to, about sexual violence?
Not a day goes by when I don't get an email from a young woman who says, thank you, and you've helped me to look at my own life and my own story and things that have happened to me. And so I think the more we talk about these kinds of violence, the easier it is to remove the stigma and the shame that comes along with them, to say, this terrible thing happened to me. And I think it's part of healing to get the story out there. I'm a private person. It's not something that I didn't think it through entirely. I didn't think the book was going to do that well. I was just like, it's a bunch of feminist essays. How well could it possibly do? So when I write, I generally write as if I'm in a vacuum and that no one's going to read what I write. I delude myself actively because otherwise it's too terrifying to think that this kind of information is out there. But I also think it's important to say, you know, bad things happen sometimes, and they happen in particular to young women. And I think that awareness is one of the ways in which we can make sure that it doesn't happen to the next generation. Like, I have two nieces, and I feel like sharing this story helps people to just, in their lives, to be more aware. Like, we know what to look for a little bit more now. And, hope, you know, and they're kick-ass little girls, too. So I just feel like they're going to be like, whew. I think we're just going to help the younger generation. I think that, you know, things have, whatever happened to us has happened to us, and you have to let it go, or as much as you can. But by telling the story, you can make sure that it doesn't happen to anyone else.
It was a way of telling it to your parents, too.
A little bit, but not on purpose. I mean, I didn't think it through. But yes, absolutely. It was a way of sort of saying, this thing happened to me. And I didn't have the right words to, even though they're wonderful parents and they're very loving and supportive, I just never knew how to say, this thing happened. But writing is where I've always turned to say the things that I haven't been able to say out loud.
And so at some point in that essay you write, I've always been fascinated by female strength. Mm-hmm. And that to survive something like that does not necessarily mean that you are strong.
No, I don't think so. I think you can survive something I don't feel particularly strong, especially when I think about some of the ways in which I acted out in the aftermath. Like, I just feel like, oh, well, I think I'm human.
I mean, the description of you turning up to school the next day, and clearly the word had got around about what had happened.
Yeah, that was not great.
And the kids, you're 12, called you a slut. Oh, that broke my heart, actually. The cruelty
Mine
of
too.
Kids. Yeah, the cruelty
Yeah,
of kids.
It was... Kids are very, very cruel. Mm. And I think when they see weakness, not even that I was weak, but that when they see a vulnerable place, they just jump on it. And because they're grateful it wasn't them. I get that. I mean, now, back then I did not get it. But now I look back and I understand you're either with the assholes or you're against them. And you don't want to be the next person that happens to, so you go along with it.
I hate rape jokes, but I hate censorship more. I hate that I have to choose. And there's really interesting observations in the book about rape humour. Mm-hmm. And at what point do we draw the line? It's a bit like the rap songs, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to draw the line. I think freedom of expression is important and artistic freedom is important. I just hate that so many rape jokes are just bad. They're just not well thought out. It's good humor and good satire attacks the strong and not the vulnerable. And all too many rape jokes are about the victims. And I'm not interested in that. I don't think that's interesting. Mm. I don't think it's reasonable. And I don't think it's funny, more importantly. But since I wrote that essay, I've heard two funny rape jokes. One was by Wanda Sykes, who talks about her detachable vagina that she wants to leave. So, like, if her rapist comes, she's like, oh, no, my vagina's at home. And it's a really good joke. And then Ever Maynard has an amazing rape joke about, oh, here's my rape, because she's walking down the street and this rapist walks up to her, and it speaks to this idea that rape is inevitable for women. And it's a really incisive look at rape culture. And so I think we have to be better about how we tell those jokes. Mm. I haven't found a man who can tell a good rape joke yet.
So sometimes people will go, well, I'm not a feminist because I'm feminine. And I have to say, right from when I was a very little girl, I resisted the word femininity. And I like frocks and I wear lipstick and all that sort of stuff, but I still cringe at that word because it was a word of weakness. And other women have tried to convince me that our femininity is our strength.
It is.
But I always thought of it as a sort of social word.
Have you looked at how painful it is to wear heels? That's strength. You know, I think femininity is incredibly strong, and I look at it as a source of strength. Mm. And this idea that feminists are all sort of burly butches, well, okay, I'm not the poster child for that argument, but, you know, I think that there's a lot of different ways to be a feminist and to look like a feminist, and I think when women say, I'm not a feminist because I'm feminine, what they're worried about is that to believe you're a feminist is to believe that you're a man? It's weird. No, I just believe I'm equal to a man. I love being a woman. I mean, I'm not good. It's good stuff. And, you know, we just have to rethink how we understand gender.
Yeah, I wonder how long we can... Whether feminism can be too broad a church, though.
No.
How broad can it be and still remain internally consistent?
Well, I do think that we have to have some key principles in common. One of the things I've struggled with in the past year or two is some women who have come to me online and said, I'm pro-life, can I be a feminist? Oh, no. And I struggle with that because I want to say yes. I want to say yes, but no. You can't believe, you don't have to get an abortion, but you can't tell other women what they should do with their bodies or their reproductive choices.
But what if they're not telling other women, they're just pro-life?
You have to be pro-choice.
So that's the non-negotiable.
Yeah. Because for me, pro-life is just I mean, being pro-choice is literally being pro-choice. You get to choose. So I choose that. I choose to support you choosing not to get an abortion, the way I choose another woman choosing to get an abortion or three or whatever. It's about choice. And sometimes you have to support choice, even if they're choices you don't understand or that you wouldn't make for personal reasons, faith-based reasons, whatever.
If they choose to be pro-life?
Then they're not feminist because they're not believing that women are equal. I mean, the only way you can be pro-life and a feminist is
if
you
sterilize
men. Pro-life,
anti-abortion, I think, is probably the more accurate term anyway.
Yeah, because
women who have abortions struggle with the choice.
Correct. It's a difficult choice.
Not all women. Some women do.
Yeah, it's not a simple choice, but it's not my place to judge how women make that choice.
Covering lots of terrain today with Dr. Roxane Gay, author of Bad Feminist. She's joining me on Life Matters on ABC RN this morning. And let's turn the conversation now over to the very enthusiastic audience joining us at the Sydney Opera House's All About Women Festival.
Let's take some questions and comments. Thank you very much.
Hello, Roxane. My name's Katinka. I'm from New Zealand and I'm a lesbian. Would you be able to talk about lesbian feminism?
Absolutely.
Do you have a particular question?
Yes.
How long have we got?
You know, that's a huge issue.
Yeah, that's right.
And historically, feminism has ignored queered women or has said, you know what, let's just deal with some of these women's issues and then we'll get to your issues later. And later happened and we still never got to our issues. And so I think that as lesbians, we need to be looking at marriage equality and some of the issues, I think, of mainstream feminism simply aren't going to affect some of us that, for example, choose not to have children, even though you can now, anything is possible. So I think we do need to make sure that we articulate what the queer agenda is within feminism.
Which is tricky, isn't it? Because within the queer community, some people go, yes, absolutely, marriage equality is about acknowledging our relationships publicly and formally and officially, but marriage has traditionally been an institution of ownership of women.
Yes, absolutely. There are many people who don't believe in marriage equality. I remember, oh, so young. I was like 21 and I was like, oh, marriage equality is nonsense. Just destroy the institution of marriage. And now I'm like, oh, marriage equality in 34 states in the U.S. It's so great.
So you too can be owned.
Yes.
Joke.
Well, I thought we were done with 50 Shades of Grey. I think it's difficult, but I think it's still an issue that we have to talk about, and we're not going to agree on everything, and we don't need to agree on everything, but I do think that intersectionality means that when we're considering feminism, we have to look at what does it mean to move through the world as a queer woman, and what are the issues that we're facing, and how do we bring them to the front of the feminist movement instead of the back where they've historically been.
Hi, Roxane. Thanks for being here. I can't wait to read your book. I do struggle with the label feminist or with any labels whatsoever because I guess I just feel I just want to be me and I don't want to have to label myself or put myself into any category. Mm-hmm. But my question's about men. You've talked about the great men in your life and we all have great men in our lives. So how do we take them along for the ride and for the, you know, on the journey to liberation for all of us?
Oh, I don't think we take them. I think they bring themselves. You know, I think that we let them know that their participation in feminism and in achieving equality or liberation is vital, that we can't have these conversations without them. But again, I'm not about like sort of facilitating it in a way, like in hand-holding. I think we just let them know what feminism is actually about, that it's not about ostracizing them. And it's, the rest of it is up to them to have that sort of responsibility. And I also understand what you're saying about labels. When I was younger, and I hate to do that. I hate to be that person, but I turned 40 and then I was just like, I know everything.
Turn 40.
What?
I said I'm about to turn 40. So.
Welcome. You're going to love it. It's the best.
Oh, wise sage soul.
Labels are hard because sometimes, like, I don't want to be constrained. by labels. I don't want someone to call me a Haitian writer and expect that my next novel is going to be about Haiti. And so actually, my next novel is about nothing related to Haiti at all. But I don't also want to disavow my Haitianness. So it's really hard because I find that labels say, this is who I am and this is how I see the world. And so my problem isn't with labels, it's with what other people do with labels. And that's what has helped me reconcile labels. It's just what they offer me. And other people are going to interpret labels in a myriad of ways, but that's their issue and not mine.
I guess I'm a bad feminist. I work for a women's fashion magazine and a teen magazine simultaneously.
A women's fashion magazine?
Just talk right into mine. Yeah.
And we have, for the teen magazine, I've pitched a couple of times to talk about feminism, and I've been told the word is too polarizing. You spoke earlier about giving cookies to men to make them comfortable. Mm-hmm. Is that something that we need to do for teenagers, or is it okay to make it a little bit polarizing until it's okay?
I think it's okay to be a little polarizing. I think that not everything needs to be comfortable and safe.
But why? The editors aren't letting her. They don't want it to be polarizing.
Yeah, I understand where the editors are coming from. You hear it all the time. And women's magazines are particularly challenging. It's a whole... And I write for women's magazines, so solidarity. It's a whole world with its own set of rules, strictures, and vocabulary. But there are other ways to talk about feminism even without conjuring up the F word for young women. And so for me, I'm always trying to infiltrate and sort of, okay, I look at everything as a problem. How do I solve this problem? Okay, I want to talk about feminism, but my bosses won't let me use the F word. And so you just have to try and think of different ways to get to that same goal.
Can you give me an example to take back?
She needs an example to take back.
Yes, absolutely.
Girls. I mean, God, there's so much.
Yeah, Girls, Rookie magazine, which doesn't always say it's a feminist magazine, but it's very much centered on young women. Oh, what's a good example?
I mean, just think of any issue that addresses young girls' needs, and that's a feminist issue, I guess.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks for your time, Roxanne. My question's along a bit of a corporate line.
Okay.
I was at an International Women's Day breakfast on Friday where the panel was asked about legislating quotas for women in leadership positions in business.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wanted to get your thoughts from the perspective of your country, and then I'm not sure how much you know about the Australian context, but just generally whether that's something that you believe in, the legislation should or shouldn't come into it, and how businesses should be responding to increasing women in leadership.
I think quotas are sometimes necessary until they're no longer necessary. And so to address a huge current imbalance, maybe quotas are where we need to start. Sometimes you have to force people to act right. Quotas are very similar to the moves that we had to make for desegregation. You had to force people to say that black children and white children could go to school together. And I think we're going to have to force corporations to have women and people of color serve on their boards. It was just announced that Germany, I think, is going to mandate that 20% of... How much? 40%. See, that's even better. 40% of the board positions of major companies have to be filled by women. Yes, that's how we have to start, because they couldn't do it on their own. And so, you know what? You don't get to try anymore.
What about in politics?
In politics, I think representation, yes, I think we could have a quota because the population is generally 50% women, 51% women.
Hi. I was wondering what you thought about our Prime Minister, Tony Abbott, being Minister for Women.
I found
that
out.
He does not have a vagina. So.
Yeah. I found that out yesterday or the day before, and I'm still giggling. Like, that is just funny. And it's hubris. And it shows how little sometimes politicians think of women that, oh, I can do this job. No, you can't. I do think that a man could do the job, but I think that he can't do the job and be prime minister at the same time. Because in many ways,
more
the two
point,
jobs
maybe.
Are going to be at opposition. So someone who's more removed needs to do so. But look at how many women are in this room. At least 8 of you could do the job. I think it's absurd, and I think it's just weird.
When you
thought about, in general, men in government making decisions for women, sort of? Like, you know, isn't it in America they're trying to make abortion illegal, though the men on the board, there's a 100% chance they will never be pregnant, so...
Yes.
Thank you.
I find it very, very frustrating. It was a couple years ago, but it was an all-male panel discussing female reproduction stuff. And I just thought, what on earth? Yeah, I mean, yeah. What on earth? You don't even know how to find a vagina. I think it's deeply, deeply problematic. Should men be part of the conversation? Absolutely, because it takes two to make a child. And I do believe that men should be part of the conversation about the fetuses that they create. I do think so, and I know that's a little controversial. I don't think they get the final decision, but I think they should be part of the conversation. So it makes sense that male legislators would be involved in some of the decision making. But when you have these panels where no women are involved and no women who have any sort of experience with reproduction, it's absurd and it's insulting. And again, it shows how little they think of us.
Thank you.
I'd just like to go back to your statement about we should let men bring themselves along on the feminist journey, because I think for at least one or perhaps two generations, looking back now in Australia anyway, we've been inviting men to come on that journey, and there are many men who are very keen to come on the journey, but there are so many structural impediments in society, like work hours and what the boss says to do, and you know, from those sorts of things to minor things like when you go to the baby health clinic with your new baby and the nurse just talks to the woman rather than both of you. I mean, just right across the whole spectrum of life, there are men who are trying to come on the journey, but they're finding that there are lots of obstacles in their way. So how do you help those men come on the journey? That was one question. And the other thing was that you started with the list of what makes a feminist, and you talked about pro-life. I wonder what other...
Non-negotiables. Thank you.
I don't think we have to do anything to make it easier for men. Again, we just don't. It's not our... I mean, the obstacles are there, but they are nothing compared to the obstacles that women are facing.
I mean, if we want to try and... We want to make things easier for us, so we want to get those obstacles out of the way. So how do we make it easier for everybody? I'm saying the wrong thing, men.
I mean, it's a good point she makes. How can we be so categorical? You know, I think of a lot of the men who end up in, you know, separated relationships and they have to negotiate access to their kids. There's a lot of very angry, disaffected, miserable men who...
Can we be as categorical? I don't... Again, men conquered the world. They flew into space with the help of women. But like, we need to help them to feel more comfortable staying at home to raise their children. No. I mean, I think that they have to man up. And we're still fighting for women to get maternity leave. So I'm not going, I just personally, and this is, I'm a bad feminist. This is me sort of acknowledging my shortcomings. I'm not going to worry about like making men feel more comfortable with participating in traditionally female tasks or, you know, whatever. It's difficult. I get it. And, you know, I read a lot of...
Well, there's a literacy that needs to be embedded in kids, boys, from day one.
Correct.
And that is a conversation women have to have.
Yes. And how do we make it so that we don't stare when it's a father who's bringing his children home, I mean, to the park, and when he's the stay-at-home parent? And how do we not belittle him for that choice, which is equally valid as a woman choosing to stay home? These are huge issues, but I don't think that they're problems that women need to solve when we're still dealing with like basic human rights for ourselves.
I'm going to take one more question because we've officially finished, but I'll grab one more question. Or if you want to just ask your questions in quick succession, we'll then see if we can do a sum up.
My question is to do with what language to use or ways to call out sexism when you're in the workplace or with strangers without just swearing at them and alienating them.
All right. Thank you. We'll get to that.
You were very keen to say you're old. Well, I'm really, really, really old. And I was in the room over 30 years ago when we were having exactly the same conversations. And I scanned the room, and I'm glad to see that most of the women in this room are half my age. It's astounding. I'm also noting that most of the women in this room are white, middle class, well-educated and of the privileged 1%, probably. I'm generalising. What do we do to actually change the composition of this room so that in 40 years' time we're not still having the same conversation?
Mine is to do with something I put on Facebook this morning, in that I put up the Annabelle Crabb article about flawed feminism, and my mother comes back, who's a lovely conservative evangelical woman who I adore, and basically says, I'd rather just be classified as a female, then I can be all that and still hopefully have the door open for me or a man give me a seat on the bus purely because he's got a heart like Hugh Jackman. Now, I understand with her she's got the fear of the 70s and certain, shall we say, loud-speaking Australian feminist women from that gender, that era of time, and she's quite afraid of that kind of mentality of feminism. So how do I approach that?
Yes, you know...
Women of privilege, although there's a great analysis of privilege.
And that's one I'm struggling to answer, and it's one I've struggled to answer because every time I go to events, I do events like this probably every week, and it's always the same composition. Where are the black people? Where are the Latinas? Where are the Asians? I mean, it's shocking. It's shocking the lack of diversity in this room. That said, I'm really glad you're all here. But how do we do that? And I think that we have to go into those communities and create the invitations, and it can't just be lip service. We have to say, not only are you invited, but you're going to be allowed to speak for yourself. You're going to be supported financially. You're not going to be asked to provide your labor for free. And so a lot has to happen for people to feel more comfortable. And then also, how do you get here? Childcare? Provide childcare for women who might have children but want to attend this. Provide transportation here. So I think a lot of it is removing the barriers that oftentimes keep people from participating in events like this. In terms of how do we have a new conversation, that's a great question, and I think it's one we're struggling with. It's appalling that we're having the same conversation now that we had 30 years ago. And I feel like, oh, I'm new to this conversation. And you know, whenever I do these events, I also meet older women who are just like, God damn. And I get it. Because if we're having this conversation when I'm 70, I'm just going to kick something.
Kick something, can we just respond to the question about calling out sexism in a workplace?
Yes.
That's a great question.
That's a practical. Very good question. It's hard. Sometimes you just have to grit your teeth and put your head down because you don't want to lose your job, because sometimes it really is that serious and you can't fight the good fight and pay your rent. But I think that there are non-confrontational ways to address sexism, to say, this is what your comment made me feel like. And I hate that, like, therapy speak, but what I hear you saying is... But sometimes that's the only way to reach people, or sometimes I just like to get in your face, like, your mama. Like, how would you feel if I said that about your mother or about your sister? Mm. And how would you feel if I spent, you know, all my workday demeaning your penis size? Sometimes you have to turn it back on them and sort of show them what it would be like if you were doing some sort of gendered insult. And I also think that you have to sometimes take official steps and work through human resources and your supervisor, and sometimes your supervisor is not going to be helpful, and that's a huge problem. I don't know, we have not solved how to deal with sexism in the workplace, as evidenced by so much going on right now.
Let's give her one hell of an applause.
There was some real energy in that room. Dr. Roxane Gay, Assistant Professor of English at Purdue University, author of Bad Feminism, and you can find out more on our website abc.net.au/rn/Life Matters. Just a heads up, we can stream the audio of this one, but we can't provide you with the podcast because we don't have the rights. Thanks, though, to the team at the Sydney Opera House and their ideas at the House series. Tomorrow's show, we're heading off to the Festival of Really Good Sex. Yes, we are. Stay with us on ABC RN. Natasha Mitchell saying bye for now.